Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is April 19th. We're going to start today with a clip. This is Jeff Deist, the president of the Mises Institute, in a talk he gave back in February at the Strategies for Liberty event in San Diego, California. The title of this speech, Libertarian, Heal Thyself. And in it, he discusses a book that was very, very influential for me called How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, written by the late Harry Brown. Jeff's talk, Harry's book, and our conversation today all touch on many of the themes that we've been discussing and exploring on School Sucks podcast for years. So I was definitely very encouraged to hear that message amplified by such an influential organization as the Mises Institute, and by its president, nonetheless. And I think it's a very, very important message for the next generation of liberty-minded people. Maybe that's you. You're young, you're energetic, you're excited about the prospects of a freer world. But as you look out at the current world, you often might feel as if maybe you didn't arrive at the right time for such a pursuit. It seems like a lot of other people, especially people your age, are throwing their support behind other things, things that happen to conflict with your vision. I think a lot of us can identify with that, and I hope this show is helpful.
But really, the great gift we get from this book is mindset. You know, Harry told us we have the ability to live freely as we wish right here and right now, at least to a much greater extent than we all think. And if Harry was right, or even partially right, then the answer to the question, what should we do, is first and foremost to improve our own lives. This is the key to everything. When we worry and stress too much about government and politics, we waste our energy and we fall into this libertarian glass half empty mentality. Harry called this the utopia trap. He said it's a mistaken belief that we have some magical right to live in a world of our liking, which is preposterous if you think about it on its face. Other people have their own opinions, their own goals, their own values. It may be completely different from ours. So quoting here from the book, Harry says, if you're not free now, it isn't because you haven't done enough to change the world. Quite the contrary, it may be that you're doing too much to try to change the world. The effort you've expended in that direction could have been used to provide freedom for yourself. Continuing, he says, you don't have to reconstruct the social order, you don't have to overpower the villains, you don't have to re-educate the world, and you don't need a miracle. You can have your freedom back anytime you choose to take it. So, is this hyperbole? Maybe a little bit. No, nobody doubts that the state can come along and ruin your day in some pretty meaningful ways. But his point remains is that everything begins and ends with you. And mindset really has far more to do with how freely you live than government or society does. And I know a lot of you know the name Albert J. Nock, who is really a tragically underappreciated libertarian theorist. He grappled with this dilemma more than a century ago. And trust me, Nock was absolutely a radical who understood the threat that government poses to us. But still, he was convinced that the only reform movement that mattered was the one that was from within, and that all we can hope to do is to present the world with what he termed one improved unit. And I think we all know this on some level, subconsciously, but I can tell you for myself, it takes a lot of strength to apply it every day. It's not easy. It's a lot easier to wake up every day and check out the latest outrage on social media. But if Harry's right, and if Albert J. Nock is right, the most important thing you can do for your liberty, far and away, is to improve yourself materially, mentally, intellectually, and otherwise. That's the real revolution. And I think, you know, it was true for the high school kids who used to visit us in Ron Paul's office when I worked for him in Washington, D.C. They'd come in and say, oh, what should I do? What can I do? And we'd say, you know, take care of yourself. Find a job. Find an apartment. Get situated in life. Find an expertise. You know, we had a lot of brilliant kids come in who had all kinds of skills in hard sciences and mathematics and all kinds of things. And they wanted to spend their time putting out yard signs for a slightly libertarianish person running for Congress. So I think it was true for these high school kids, and I think it's true for everyone in this room. Nobody listens to poor, unsuccessful people. It's just a simple fact of life. And that's what Harry Brown understood. That's what Albert J. Nock understood. So focus on your own life. Free yourself mentally from all this angst about government. Get on with the best possible life for you and your family. Save yourself first. Find your own freedom in an unfree world.
The timing of this show is interesting, too. I've been watching some of this footage and listening to interviews about the incident in Berkeley, California, at this free speech rally. And, you know, I watched Gavin McGinnis, I watched Stephen Molyneux talk about it. And the sort of military terms that people are using to describe this clash between Proud Boys or conservatives or libertarians, so-called, against Antifa on the streets of Berkeley, not really super excited about that. And what it's kind of setting up, and I've heard a lot of this from the people who were there, people who were interviewed, is you're either willing to do something or you're not. And doing something means, you know, going to the streets and engaging with these stupid, dangerous people. And it's a real shame if it's come to that. It's not a particularly appealing idea for me to think about, you know, everything that I built in my life, everything that I've worked for, everything that I've learned could be undone by a flying brick to the back of the head, like something you would see at the Five Points in Gangs of New York. And I didn't really like people presenting, especially young, excited, passionate, energetic people who are also, to a certain extent, driven by anger, something I can certainly identify with, anger towards this radical left, this dangerous, violent left, the Antifa people, that this is what doing something looks like, that this is what fighting for freedom has to look like. And if you watch some of these videos, it really isn't so easy to make a distinction between good guys and bad guys as far as behavior is concerned. I even understand the argument to a certain point. Like, these leftists, there are no rules of engagement for them. So now I'm sorry I'm even using military terms, but they're not playing by any rules. And what the other side is saying, those who see themselves as defenders of freedom, more and more I hear this, we have to play by the same rules to win a war. Now, I very much believe that the left increasingly sees this as a kind of war. And those who, again, see themselves as defenders of freedom, from the video that I've seen, are being pulled into that mindset as well. And maybe that's where we're at. Maybe I'm being naive. But from the behavior in these videos, from the language in the interviews, it seems like there is some kind of nobility in being an expendable foot soldier in a grand struggle. And I worry that because a lot of these skirmishes occur in and around the college setting in the United States, more and more young people who are, you know, passionate and, again, angry, are going to find themselves in the middle of this situation where you fight for freedom with a stick in your hand and a bike helmet and a gas mask on your head. This is what is being romanticized currently on some very large and influential pro-freedom platforms. And if you're not willing to do that, if you're not willing to join that collective and jump into that fray where you risk traumatic brain injury or death, then you are lacking in character and worthiness. And sorry to be a dick, but that sounds like the kind of mindset that the 19th century Prussian aristocracy that we've referenced, I believe, several times on this show in the past would be, you know, pretty enthusiastic about. And it's kind of ironic that this is the new option. And you're going to see more of this, I promise. This might seem alarmist because this was one incident. It was a relatively small group of people. But if you pay attention to the positive light in which this recent incident is being projected to a great number of people, it's a little bit alarming. The irony is here in New Hampshire, in the circles that I've traveled, there has been a conflict that I've paid attention to for a decade about this sort of three approaches to moving the ideas of liberty forward. The first is the personal. The second is the political. And the third is the civil disobedience. But it seems like now there's a lot of serious talk about adding a fourth option that isn't particularly evolutionary in my mind. So on this show, I renew my commitment to focus on that first option, which I really see as foundational in this struggle. It's not to say that I don't understand the defensive rationale of the political route or the effectiveness, at least as far as public relations is concerned, of the civil disobedience route. But we've seen too many unfortunate examples of what those strategies look like when the first is being ignored. And I really, really hope that I don't have to accept the necessity of this fourth approach. But I guess time will tell. My guest today is the president of the Mises Institute, Jeff Deist. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm terrific. Thanks for coming on the show. I wanted to actually start by talking about an event you guys have coming up this summer. I think this is something my audience would be interested in. It's an annual event, Mises University. And I think it might be a nice way for my listeners who are unfamiliar with the Mises Institute to learn a little bit about what you do there.
Well, Mises University is a one-week crash course in economics, what we would consider proper economics, and that it's very important to disabuse, especially young people, of the economics they might have been taught in high school or in their undergraduate classes. So we have a one-week program here where people come to our campus here in Auburn, Alabama, and spend a week with us. Now, most of the people who come are undergraduate to maybe graduate age, maybe 20 to 26 years old, but there are outliers. Sometimes kids who are very advanced, still in high school, come, and sometimes a 40 or 50-year-old comes because they're just interested in learning more. So it's a fun week. It's an intensive week. It's actually free to attendees. You have to apply, and we limit it to 150 because of the physical constraints of our building. But beyond getting to Auburn, there's no cost to attendees. It's very much an intensive, life-changing week for a lot of people who come. So if you're interested in economics, if you're interested in Austrian theory, if you're interested in libertarianism generally, go to Mises.org, check out our events page. It might be something that you enjoy, and it might be something you want to bookmark for a future year, or if you have a son or daughter, niece or nephew for whom you think it might be beneficial, send them the link.
Absolutely. And you guys have enrollment open until May for that? It's not filled yet?
Well, it's a rolling admission, and we advise everyone whether they've been accepted at the same time. So you can still apply. There are some people turned away because we get more than 150 applications generally.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that sounds wonderful. Outside of Mises University, unfortunately, there are all these other colleges and universities, and in a lot of places, things aren't going so well, and that's going to make up a bulk of our conversation today. So recently on my show, we've been discussing the behavior and the attitudes of college students, and more importantly, how they got there. And I heard two talks that you gave. One was actually the first time I ever heard you speak, and it was surprisingly wasn't that long ago. And then the most recent time I heard you speak, and these two talks, interestingly enough, kind of bookended the 2016 presidential campaign and election. Just from, you know, listening to what you said and taking some notes, I thought it would be really interesting to get your thoughts and observations about these identity politics issues, these PC issues that are really permeating the colleges. And it really seems to intensify over the last 2 years, really since you guys did that event. I think it was in Texas. It was called Against PC, the Fight for Free Expression. So you have some college speaking engagements coming up. What is your message? I mean, I'm sure maybe you're in some cases there's specific topics you're going to speak on. But if you had a message for the college students of today, especially the ones who would come to hear you speak around this issue, around this problem, what would it be?
Well, my number one message for any college student, unless they were in a certain technical specialty or wanted to become, let's say, an engineer or a medical doctor, my number one message for college students would be to drop out. Universities are almost criminal organizations at this point, at least the publicly funded ones. And the vast majority of attendees at this point, not always in history, but at this point, are being sold a bill of goods as to how much their income will increase as a result of getting an undergraduate degree over their lifetimes relative to the costs of attending, and even worse, the debt that they might incur. I read an interesting article the other day that talked about how scholarships are really just a form of variable pricing, right? We'd be outraged if automobile dealers or home sellers charge different prices to different people based on how affluent they thought they were. But that's really what scholarships amount to. We have all different people paying all different prices for school. And it's really become a situation where college has become a form of indoctrination. I mean, I am shocked by the regression we've seen in just the last couple of years on campuses. It really seems like the environment for rational thinking or libertarian thinking has become so poisoned that I really question whether young people, and I know what of I speak. I have two children myself. I really question whether college is a good deal anymore for the majority of young people who are oftentimes spending well into six figures to attend and giving up four of their most youthful years to do so. I think we've reached peak education. I think that this is an unsustainable system that is going to have to change radically. And as Professor Peter Klein points out, universities are still basically employing the same teaching methods that Socrates employed thousands of years ago, meaning they still have lectures, one-directional lectures from a professor at the front of the classroom. Mm-hmm. I mean, the digital revolution is ripe to upend this. There's no reason that traditional brick and mortar universities have to continue to exist at the exorbitant prices they're charging. And if you look at most state-funded universities, Auburn University included, here in my town, all the growth in those universities in the past 20, 30 years is at the administrative level. They don't necessarily employ more professors. Their student bodies have not necessarily increased. What has increased dramatically is the number of six-figure salaried bureaucratic administrators. This is an absolutely almost an incomprehensible phenomenon across the university systems. And it all adds up to a bad deal for students. It all adds up to a bad deal for parents who are spending their retirement funds or their 401k funds or whatever it takes to get their kids through this. And so I got to admit, I'm shocked by how quickly the educational system in this country, higher ed, has devolved. And I'm very, very concerned. And on a personal level, I am very, very, very seriously looking at alternatives for my own kids who may well want to go into math or programming or something where they don't need some left-wing professor forcing them to hear some sort of social justice agenda in a political science class, for instance.
Sure. And what a lot of people don't realize, even in those, you know, more useful science programs, is that colleges still have a core curricula where you would be exposed to that messaging anyway. And one of the recurring themes that I've heard in a lot of your talks is personal freedom, in the spirit of Harry Brown, building liberty from the individual up. And, you know, these institutions today, it's become much more apparent to me just in the last couple of years, are antithetical to that pursuit or that idea. You're losing freedom intellectually. You're losing freedom socially. I've been talking to college students about just the social environment of the campus and how a kind of conformity is often necessary to not be alienated. And of course, you're losing freedom financially. You spoke about this, these enormous debts that people have to incur just to make it through 4 years, never mind, you know, the six that it takes in many fields to be competitive today. So yeah, these institutions are almost across the board anti-individual liberty today.
Well, it's true. And it's ironic that we send our kids to college to get stupid.
Right.
Because they learn things that just aren't true. They learn terrible things about Western civilization and culture. They learn terrible things about capitalism. They learn terrible things about the literary canon of dead white males like Shakespeare. They learn terrible things
about Western philosophers. For instance, in the Greek tradition, they learned terrible, untrue things about history and colonialism. They learned terrible, untrue things about government, and they learned terrible, disastrously terrible, untrue things about economics. So this seems like an odd thing to be paying for, but there you have it. And what you really have to understand is that everything government touches, it taints.
Mm-hmm.
And government overwhelmingly runs education in this country, even in the ostensibly or nominally private schools. Federal student loans are still the driving force in secondary education. So it's a corrupt system, but we've got a digital revolution which has made the transmittal of information so much cheaper, so much easier. It's eliminated so many gatekeepers, and here we are with virtually all the knowledge in human history on an iPhone in our hands. And yet we're listening to these dim-witted left-wing professors. It doesn't make any sense, and I think that things that don't make sense eventually come to an end.
Absolutely. So, yes, we have an enormous complex problem that we're facing here with not just education generally, which on my show we don't call education. We call it schooling. I'm looking for, a better term now for higher education, because that's a misnomer as well. But this government school complex is enormous. And if we just want to focus on colleges, we have a left-wing economic agenda. We have the influences of the most toxic aspects of the postmodern philosophy. We have the involvement of course, politics, but also think tanks. And this is like a huge iceberg. But the tip of that iceberg that most of the public gets to see, who doesn't really pay attention to most of the politics of higher ed, is called PC, right? That's what's kind of bled out into popular culture, or this language policing. And it's become more apparent in the last couple of years. But let's talk about this problem. It's interesting. You gave this talk at this Mises event that I mentioned, Against PC, the Fight for Free Expression. That was October 2015. And I just re-listened to it. Gosh, that seems like an entirely different and in many ways much simpler world than the one we live in today. But, you gave this talk where you called PC a virus. You called it a black art. And based on your observations, just I guess over the last, what are we talking, year and a half, and all the news events in higher education that have been packed into that year and a half, how has your thinking evolved or perhaps intensified around the PC issue?
Well, it's terrifying, really, because the policing of speech, which is, of course, designed to also ultimately police thought and thus conduct, is something we see in totalitarian societies throughout history. And we've come to think of PC as an issue among others, like abortion or foreign policy or trade policy, like PC is an issue. PC isn't an issue. It's instead a way that we look at and frame the debate on all issues. It's this enforced monopoly of thought. Now, it's mostly a left-wing phenomenon. I don't let the right completely off the hook here. There is, I think, a brand of right-wing PC. But for the most part, as libertarians, we have to understand that at this point in history, it is left progressives who hold virtually all the power in society, government, media, education, corporate, etc. That's just the reality. I think sometimes libertarians get a little silly when they fail to recognize this. For the most part, right now, it's a form of cultural leftism that's controlling political correctness. And I think Trump's election has sent PC into some sort of hyperdrive. I was astonished the other day to read about a letter written by a group of students at Pomona College, which is part of the Seven Sisters Colleges of Claremont McKenna in Southern California. And just the language used and the demands made of the administration would have seemed exotic or esoteric even just maybe 5 years ago.
Right.
So the pace of this is accelerating. And at some point, we have to accept and wake up to the fact that the left has poisoned the minds of millions of people, also, especially young people, in ways that are going to have to be undone lest we get into a very nasty, potentially even violent situation in America. You know, this idea that people are victims of something, and that free speech must now take a back seat to the feelings or ambitions of particular pet groups in society is just unsustainable. It's not something that liberty-minded people can accept, and nor should we accept it. And when people say, well, it's just language, it's just, you know, being kind and being nice, that's not true. And it's a very slippery slope into a totalitarian society. And you can talk to people still alive today who lived in Nazi Germany. You can talk to people who lived in the former Soviet Union who absolutely were very careful with what they said because, you know, your neighbors could snitch on you. Thought police is not just something from a movie. It's something that has existed in human society in the memories of people who are still alive today. And hate crime legislation, which is now ensconced in Europe and in Canada, is something that is very possible in America. The First Amendment is simply not considered sacrosanct by millions of people, especially younger people. So, you know, PC is not some right-wing talking point from Fox News. I'm the furthest person you're going to find from a right-wing Fox News head. PC's real. It is mostly a left-wing phenomenon, and libertarians have to understand that libertarianism is not a suicide pact.
Right.
We have to fight this stuff, and we have to fight it on all fronts.
Yeah, and we're going to wrap up today's show by talking about that. But before that, I think you mentioned this. We can kind of zoom out for a larger historical lesson there, that this is nothing new. Language has always been a tool of control and a means of obtaining more freedom when speech is free. So there's a lot of interesting stories I've heard, actually, about Mises himself, who was one of these people fleeing an oppressive state, Nazi Germany, where there were considerable sustained efforts to control the way people spoke, the way people wrote, subsequently the way people thought and felt and ultimately acted. And he wound up with some exposure to the American university system, saying, huh, a lot of this looks and sounds pretty familiar, right?
Yeah, it was really a tragic story in some ways, in the sense that what he fled in Nazi Germany and Austria, and then later had to flee Switzerland to come to New York, he then saw an academic establishment here in the United States that had been sort of stewed in the 1930s radicalism of Marxism and Keynesianism. So the underlying impulse to control language and to control academic thought and to control speech is nothing new. It exists in every society. The question is how hard we work to tamp it down. And one of the great blows made against this kind of oppressive thinking was, of course, the First Amendment, one of the best things to come out of the U.S. founding and our Constitution. It's pretty unique in history, and it's pretty unique in politics or in governance today. It's something that we ought to take very seriously. And, maybe we've just had it so easy and we've had such soft lives. We haven't had to endure the kind of collectivism that Mises had to endure and flee from, that we've just lost sight of how slippery the slope really is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems one of the reasons why I've wanted to talk to more college students about what campus life is actually like is because for so many of us, a lot of this conflict seems very abstract. You can see online, it's almost like a form of entertainment before it's something that people consider a real threat. You know, another thing that's interesting that you talked about at that event in Texas was Edward Bernays. We've talked about him a bunch on my show in the past. And it's interesting, Bernays, the father of public relations, despite not really being an ideologue, he had some attitudes that really led to him being the embodiment of 20th century progressivism in a lot of ways. He saw people as basically irrational animals who were in need of strict, constant guidance. And I was wondering how studying Bernays helped you develop a better understanding of how this PC problem or PC itself has kind of weaved itself into the fabric of American culture over the last few decades.
Yeah, Bernays is great. He's really somebody I recommend people read to understand how things work in the public sphere. And of course, social media has changed and also intensified this. His books are short, they're easily digestible, but he's really responsible for helping us understand the herd mentality in modern societies, in Western societies especially. And, you know, the herd mentality is true.
Yeah.
People tend to avoid conflict. People tend to be timorous pack animals. And so as drip by drip, PC becomes entrenched in our society, most people will go along with it. That's just part of human nature, and it's part of how we act as social animals. So propaganda used to be a word for advertising until World War II changed it into a bad word. So there's a lot of things in our society that most people don't view as propaganda, which really is. And reading Bernays can open up a whole new world to you. It'll make you understand, first of all, in politics especially, whenever you hear a politician or a political entity issue some statement, you know, there's always the real reason and the stated reason.
Mm.
So Bernays was a master. He may have been sort of an amoral figure, but as a craftsman, he was absolutely unparalleled, I think. And it's great. It's interesting how his work holds up today.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it brings me to a question that I hate to have to ask. I wish this wasn't the situation. I became a libertarian in 2006, and part of the bedrock foundation of building that philosophy for me was a kind of faith in my fellow man. I was really put off by the left and at that time the right, which, well, no, it wasn't the right. It was the neoconservatives, which also part of the left, you know, and the effort to control people, or this foregone conclusion that people were stupid and needed to be controlled and needed to have their opinion shaped in ways that should be apparent are really intellectually insulting. And, you know, my counter to that was, no, you know, people are more capable. People are more rational. And I'm sitting here 11 years later after, you know, having been exposed to a decade of examination of the public through social media, through YouTube. And, you know, now I'm kind of questioning that optimism. And I don't know if that's something that you've wrestled with or you've talked about with other libertarians who may feel like that view of humanity at one point in the past, before there was so many, you know, camera lenses and so much scrutiny on the public, especially in a political context, was available. Are people looking back and saying, well, that was kind of naive? Because I feel that way sometimes.
Well, that's funny. You know, social media plus the comment section on articles has let us know what everyone's really thinking. 30 years ago, these would have been private thoughts they kept to ourselves. We didn't know how horrible everybody was. But look, whether you think man is fallen and generally bad, or whether you think man is righteous and generally good, what we do know is in either case, everything the state does makes things worse.
Sure.
So I think as libertarians, we don't really have to accept any view of man as basically good or bad. What we do know is that creating big gangs never improves human society. So it's kind of a rhetorical or an academic question for me anyway. I think that humans are generally cooperative. There is certainly a segment in any human society that might be psychopathic that needs to be controlled. But as with anything else, control of criminal activity and pathology, murderous impulses, the impulse to commit fraud or theft, is always better handled in non-political ways, just like the provision of housing or food or shoes or you know, mobile devices is always best handled privately. We know these things conceptually, and we also have a lot of historical evidence for this. So
right.
Not just the theory, but also the history. So I don't think we have to answer the question about whether humans are natural libertarians or natural collectivists. Either way, I think our mission is the same, which is to try to create structures that are more libertarian and less collectivist. There's always a better outcome that way.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's important to point out the idea of working at this from the personal level. You gave a talk a couple months ago called Libertarian Heal Thyself. And I really appreciated that because it dealt with one of the themes that we've been dealing with on this show for years. So often focus is pulled out of things we can actually control and sort of redevoted to things that we can't. And, you know, with all the attention and energy and emotion directed towards these things that we can't control, it leads to us feeling at times, especially when we're young. I think I went through a lot of this when I was young, pretty small and not very efficacious. And you talked a little bit about kind of returning the focus to the individual pursuit, that idea that I mentioned before, you know, building liberty from the individual up. So I wanted to just put that idea out there. As we talk about how to fight back, especially as we're trying to make a message here for people who are in college against these forces that we're talking about, against this PC social justice identity politics problem that has become so pervasive in higher education for the last couple of years. So let's just talk about that a little bit, the response.
Well, first and foremost, for a young person, if you really want to go to college, you know, see if you can find a way to do as much as possible maybe at the community college level, to get those first couple years credits out of the way cheap, see what you can do online. I would even venture that you might be better off taking your time and working for a while, then going for a couple semesters, working for a while, and coming out of it all without debt than you are just rushing through and then having debt. Because you might find yourself in a position where you chose a major or a career path that caused you to have a bunch of debt to get a credential, let's say a CPA license. And then, you know, fast forward 5 years later, you're 30 years old, you hate being a CPA, but you still have college debt. So, you know, I would just advise people, especially young people, take a look at your personal life and think about what you can do. Tom Woods has some great information on his website about starting your own online business. Think about what you can do either online or in creative ways to either bypass college or to go to college cheaply, because I think we're reaching an era where debt slavery is no joke, and if it starts early on in life, it's going to affect you for a long, long time. And I think that's the most important thing: is are you learning or developing a skill that you can't necessarily get the traditional way? That's what I would advise young people to focus on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that you talked about is realizing people still have the freedom to act. There's the question, have the PC walls or institutional left walls really closed in on us as much as we think? Or are libertarians actually failing to realize the space that they still have available to act? What you're talking about here is sort of the opposite of realizing that space. It's kind of stealing that space from yourself by putting yourself into one of these institutions where you're going to come out where your life is going to be very directed for a great number of years, 20 or 30 years, by the fact that you have tremendous debts to pay back. And that's going to affect all the decisions that you're able to make in life. And that's going to lead to, for people who love freedom, that's going to lead to possibly a somewhat unsatisfying existence.
You know, we're all guilty of this. I'm guilty of this myself every day, is not realizing the spaces we have around us that are free. We tend to focus so much on the state and what it does and on taxes and on regulations and on all these laws and the latest craziness in the news. And it pulls us around. We end up like a ping pong ball. And it's never healthy. It takes away from our focus. It's easy to get pulled into that and to see – to see the freedoms we've lost rather than the freedoms that are available to us. And what we have to remember is history is full of examples where freedom wasn't restored or won back incrementally or gradually. That incrementalism works great for the left. Look at the history of the 20th century, the progressive century, drip by drip.
Right.
Social Security, the Fed, income tax, huge wars and entitlements, a regulatory state. All of these things happen incrementally, drip by drip, But oftentimes freedom is actually won back much more rapidly. I mean, no one really could time or predict the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s. So this is something where we have to understand that sometimes things happen in ways that surprise us. And I think the most important thing for all of us to understand is that if we allow ourselves to be distraught about us, if we allow ourselves to be demoralized and pessimistic in our thinking, first and foremost, that means that the bad guys, the totalitarians, have won. And second of all, I think it makes us unworthy of our ancestors. Mm-hmm. You know, our ancestors did what they had to do. They lived in much tougher times in terms of physical comfort. And, you know, many of them traveled from another land to get here at great personal expense, at great personal risk. There was no social safety net. And they basically just went out there and kicked ass because they had to, and there was no going back. So I think sometimes it's easy for us to fall into a self-pitying mode. And I get that. I'm guilty of this myself. Don't get me wrong. But we got to snap out of it and look at the opportunities there in front of us. And you just never know the way the state can be exposed. Look at Uber. Uber came out of nowhere. And it immediately exposed the taxi medallion system as a farce. It immediately showed that the best regulator is the crowdsourced information on the app itself. And it basically just showed how terrible taxi service is, especially in the suburbs, especially when you have to rely on a cab for, let's say, an early morning airplane flight. And it's just an unbelievably swift example of the old state system being exposed for what it is, and a new technological, more libertarian method coming out of nowhere. So, you know, take heart. The next Uber, the next disruptor in some other industry is out there.
Absolutely. Something you said actually reminded me of this quote. I don't know the quote perfectly, but the gist of it is just kind of going back to earlier America. Tough times produce strong people. Strong people produce good times. Good times produce not so strong people, you know. And I think that I and certainly people younger than me are in that position where we've never been effectively challenged. And you see the resistance to challenge in the current generation of these college students today, even when it comes to, you know, pretty non-threatening intellectual challenges, it would seem. So that kind of idea of seeking the tough time for oneself, do you think is good advice? Like finding those ways to make oneself stronger through adversity, through challenge. It could be translated into advice for libertarians and conservatives to go to college where they would find, you know, maybe one of the most difficult situations of their lives for 4 years.
Well, it is important that we get out of our comfort zone and that Right. we talk to other people, not just libertarians. There's no question about that. And I think that we do need to challenge ourselves. I think that stress is a part of human nature. It's what drives us. It's what motivates us in the morning. And our great grandparents didn't have to create stress. They Right. you know, they had to worry about the crops, or they had to worry about the dentist, or whatever they had to worry about, whereas we tend to have to create drama for ourselves. But, you know, to get back to the earlier point about individuals, you know, that's really where the revolution takes place. It's on an individual level. And, you know, living by example will convince far more of your friends, family, coworkers, whoever you come in contact with in your life. Living by example will convince far more of them that libertarianism might be rational than you know, writing a blog post or giving a talk somewhere. So, you know, action always beats words.
Absolutely. So, Jeff, thank you so much for your time. This 35-minute conversation actually provides a really good synopsis of a lot of the themes we've been promoting on my show for years. So I appreciate you articulating a lot of these things. And before I let you go, if you have any events or speaking engagements that you'd like to let my audience know about, feel free to take this last minute to plug away.
Well, we'll be in a few different cities later this year. We'll be in Seattle in about a month with Bob Murphy.
Oh, great.
And Tom Woods and Doug Casey will be in several other cities, including New York City, in the fall. So if you just go to our website, Mises.org, and look at the events page, And I think this week, this Thursday evening, I'll be at a YAL event in Syracuse, at Syracuse University on the drug war. So that should be interesting as well.
Awesome. Jeff, thank you so much for your time.
Great talking to you. Thanks.